Funding for Think comes from SMU Master of Liberal Studies programs.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Why is it so hard for writers, artists, and musicians to earn a living? A tiny fraction of superstars are still getting rich, maybe, but large numbers of other people in creative fields are struggling mightily just to hang on to a decent middle-class lifestyle. And the challenges these days extend beyond those producing art to affect those in the important but often overlooked institutions that support the work of artists, places like record stores, bookstores, and small galleries. My guest believes a number of things are to blame, from corporate consolidation and profit motives to avarice within the music industry to self-important academic disdain for any work that could be considered middle brow. He joins us now to talk about what might revive America's willingness to support arts and culture. Journalist Scott Timberg is a former arts reporter for the LA Times, who now contributes to the New York Times and to Salon. His new book is called Culture Crash: The Killing of the Creative Class. Scott, welcome to Think.
Thanks very much.
You write about this not only as an observer, but as someone who has experienced the direct impact of shrinking support for creative professions. A few years ago, you had just received a raise and a stellar performance report, and then weeks after that, you were told, clean out your desk.
Yeah, a real shock to the system. In 2008, a lot of things, this was after the Lehman Brothers collapse, and my editor lost her job. The woman who sat next to me lost her job. There were, you know, something like 100 people just at the paper I worked at, the LA Times. What was interesting about that is, you know, it wasn't just me and it wasn't just journalists. I mean, my best friend in LA was a landscape painter who lived in Venice Beach, which is historically, you know, an artist's neighborhood. And when the economy collapsed, he couldn't make a living either. He had a kid and a wife, and he saw his income cut in half and ended up having to leave California. He drifted around for a while. He's, sort of dealing with the same kind of bizarre economic hollowing out that I have, and that my photographer friends have, my musician friends have. You know, there are people all over the sort of English-speaking world. This is happening in Britain to some extent, too. The situation in Europe is a little bit different. But what I realized, it took a while to figure it all out, but it wasn't just any one field. You know, it wasn't just visual people. It wasn't just writers. It wasn't just musicians. There was this sort of larger crisis in the creative class that we weren't, for the most part, hearing about. If you lived it, if it happened to your brother, your friend, you know, something like that, it was very real to you, but you weren't reading about it in papers. You weren't, for the most part, hearing it in radio coverage of the recession, magazines, television, etc. So I decided it was important to try to tell that story.
And of course, that was a catalyst to the economic downturn. But now, if that were the only problem, then now that the economy has come roaring back across many sectors, it would seem that the creative class would not be struggling in the way that it is.
That's exactly right. I mean, there's no, you know, one aspect of you know, there's no single cause and no single, because of that, there's no single solution. I mean, my book really looks at economic factors, technological factors, you know, digital technology, the internet, and also cultural factors, social norms that are kind of harder to sum up. But, you know, the economic issue here goes beyond, you know, the sort of the 2008 crisis, which, you know, we're in a recovery now. It can be hard to see. I know a lot of people who are still hurting. Texas is a bit of an anomaly. It's been much stronger. California, for a lot of where I live, for a lot of this period, has had unemployment up around 12%. LA County, I live in LA, was even higher, you know, for years. And you know, California and LA are places with, you know, film people, music people, you know, writers, et cetera. So that it hit the creative class on the West Coast extremely hard. Oregon wasn't any better. The problem with the recovery, and I mean, I'm all for it. You know, it's hard to sort of object to an economic recovery, and I think it's finally starting. Though there's been so many false dawns, it's kind of easy to think that you know. It's easy to be skeptical, but I'd like to think we're really at a point where it's going to continue to move forward. The problem is that I think it's 90% or maybe 95% or something like that of the economic gains since the recovery have gone to the top 1%, and the median income for the middle class is actually lower than it was when the recovery started a few years ago. So it's good for the big corporations. They have record profits. They're making money hand over fist. You know, the top tier of American wealth, you know, the top 10% of the 1%, say the Waltons, you know, the family that owns Walmart. These people are doing great. And there are a few middle class people who have sort of picked up a few scraps here and there. But for most of us, we're sort of waiting for the recovery to become more than just a spectator sport.
Let's talk about your definition of creative class. Among the things you disagree with Richard Florida about is who belongs to it.
Yeah, Richard Florida has done really important work in defining and describing and sort of theorizing on the creative class. You know, for him, he's written some very influential and popular books about the creative class, and he defines it sort of as people who work with their brains at high levels. So you have software engineers, I think pharmaceutical researchers, lawyers may actually be in there as well. I wanted to, and again, this is useful, you know, useful as far as it goes. I wanted to look at creative class in a slightly different sense. I wanted to look at artists, musicians, but also the people who made their lives possible. So we're talking about the dude at the record store, you know, at like, say, Waterloo Records or something in Austin, which is a place I used to love when I went to South by Southwest. It's the woman who sells you books, you know, at an independent bookstore. It's a person who works at a record label. It's a newspaper art critic. It's an editor at a publishing house. So there's a sort of layer, you know, there's a number of layers of people who you don't normally hear about, but they're crucial to the wheels of culture rolling. I think of it as an ecology. You know, it's sort of like a forest ecology where you have a lot of interdependent elements that seem disparate, but they all operate together. And when one aspect of them, can be a small aspect at first, is disturbed, the whole thing can start to erode.
I like that approach to defining things because it, again, sort of chips away at, there's so much mythology surrounding people who are artists. And, you know, many of them, I suppose there are those who labor in solitude and are not influenced by anything else going on around them. But, you know, most people have to get through their days and they have to have, you know, some kind of administrative support and, you know, places to gather and places to meet, that sort of thing.
Yeah, I mean, you know, you've just mentioned a bunch of things that are important to the book. I mean, very quickly, places to gather, places to meet. You know, I realized I had a panel here in L.A. There was an architect who's very interested in urban spaces named Barbara Bester on the panel with me. And I realized, you know, my book or my vision of culture is so much about urban spaces and the way people come together in urban spaces. And so many chapters of culture that I value. You know, there's a bit on Austin, you know, the 70s Austin music scene. There's a bit on the LA art scene in the 60s, which was based around a gallery called the Ferris Gallery. And I look at poetry in Boston in the 50s, where there was a place called the Poets Theater and a number of other places where people would hang out. And those spaces are essential for certainly the growth of a school and a sort of, you know, consortium or sort of posse of artists or musicians, and for something like theater, dance, you know, performing arts, even more true. You mentioned mythology. I mean, so here are the two big, seems to me, mythologies about artists, though there are more. I talk about it in my book a bit. One of them is that that artists are either these sort of heroes, you know, sort of Michelangelo or Kanye West or something like that. And these people do or did exist. You know, they're hugely famous, hugely rich people who make substantial art. I don't want to denigrate them, but they are an incredibly tiny, tiny sliver of the real life of culture in this or any other society. And the sort of counter myth is that, this goes back to 19th century Paris, is that artists are these sort of, you know, gutter dwelling, you know, absinthe sipping, you know, kind of dodgy, you know, ruffians. And again, there was some truth to that. You know, Baudelaire, you know, hung out with people like that, and Toulouse-Lautrec did as well. And it's not like it hasn't ever existed historically. It did. That was an important, powerful art movement. But most of the creative class, and I mean here a jazz guitarist and a poet, and you know, pick what you want. You know, rock. You know, rock musicians. You know, even for bands that we've heard of. You know, most of these people are middle class, and they're exposed to the same pressures, you know, that other middle class people are, you know, they're as vulnerable when the safety net is slashed as any, you know, teacher or, you know, somebody working on the assembly line at Detroit. You know, they're caught in the same web, and they're exposed in the same ways.
Journalist Scott Timberg is my guest. He's a former arts reporter for the LA Times and author of a new book called Culture Crash, The Killing of the Creative Class. You can be part of our conversation by calling in to 1-800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org or send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Master of Liberal Studies programs. Accepting applications for summer and fall to design your own Master of Liberal Studies degree at SMU with concentrations in human rights, creative writing, and organizational dynamics. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with journalist Scott Timberg, formerly an arts reporter for the LA Times, author now of the new book Culture Crash, The Killing of the Creative Class. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372. So, Scott, to your point before the break that, you know, the majority of artists are sort of middle-class people who are working on these creative jobs and producing things that the world seems to want and need. What has made it more difficult for these people to just take home a paycheck for doing these forms of work?
Well, you know, there's not been any conspiracy. There have been a number of things that they're all sort of operating on their own, you know, their own schedule. They all have their own roots and causes and so on. Some of it is the mythology that I was talking about before. Some of it is, you know, if we're talking about the institutions that have traditionally supported artists and people who work with artists, institutions that aggregate risk, you know, so to speak, a record label or a publishing house means that if your book or record doesn't sell hugely, you're in the same sort of pool as somebody whose work might, which means you might get a second shot at it. The bookstores and video stores and record stores that employ people who care about culture and like evangelizing for it, these have been destroyed by a number of things. I mean, the internet is part of it, obviously, Amazon and things like that. But, you know, again, the shifting of capital, you know, the sort of what you could call trickle-up economics, which is kind of the end result of the Reagan Revolution and the members of both parties that have helped further it. You know, this means that money is in fewer and fewer hands. It means urban rents have gone up. I mean, in Los Angeles, where I live, and in New York and San Francisco and many other cities, rents have gone up 10% or more, you know, for the last few years. And this is, again, at a time that's been very tough for middle-class people. Meanwhile, you know, say music industry revenues have been plummeting. And when you have the money that working artists and, you know, working members of the creative class make stagnant or flat or falling, and you have the cost of living going up in cities. Cities are traditionally where, you know, artists, musicians, dancers, actors, and so on have come together to collaborate, get to know each other. That's not going to end well for anybody. I mean, I guess it ends well for the landlords, and it's great. It's great for the 1%, but it's not good for the rest of us. And again, there are also, you know, social norms and sort of what I call bad ideology. There's this idea that the market knows best, that, you know, the symphony or the opera house or the theater company should be able to make its, you know, pay its way the same way that the local, you know, tire shop could. And that's a nice idea. I mean, I wish we could open an opera house that could make a profit, but it just doesn't work. And you know, you're in a state with, you know, one of the best opera and most progressive opera companies in the country, Houston Grand Opera, I think it's called, right? And you know, the best work in certain fields just does not sync up that well with the market economy. And frankly, opera, I mean, I'm a believer in capitalism, by the way, but, you know, opera, dance, poetry, visual art, storytelling. A lot of these fields go back way, way before the coming of capitalism to 18th century England. I mean, thousands of years, you know, of having a different economic model that was based on patronage and royal support or church support or other systems. And capitalism has been good for a lot of things. It works in many contexts, but capitalism is really recent. You know, culture goes, and in some countries, it's still sort of struggling to make sense with the lives of people. In the West, sort of Anglo-American world, it goes back, 2.5 centuries, you might say, and it's had an imperfect relationship to culture, and I feel like the sort of tensions, sort of like a quarreling couple that's been quarreling for years and years, and it seems like it's headed toward a pretty nasty divorce.
You lament the loss of respect for middlebrow culture in America. First of all, what do you mean by middlebrow, and who's responsible for making it such a target of derision?
Yeah, I mean, this is a slippery and kind of complicated term, and I don't mean, work that's sort of unchallenging and uninteresting. Middlebrow is not just a kind of, this is a long debate that for somebody in my generation, I'm 45, the term had largely dropped out of the discourse by the time I was in school. And if you ever heard the term, it was delivered with a sneer. What I'm talking about is, I don't mean obvious or weak art. I'm talking about a notion that arts and culture came out of, were aspects of human achievement. There was a period in the, say, 40s, 50s, 60s, some of the 70s, where the arts and culture weren't about money, entirely. I mean, yes, some of these, records, you could buy a Miles Davis record. He was on a label, but you had the spreading of paperback houses, classics, on published in paperback. You had serious authors, serious artists on the cover of Time magazine. You had Leonard Bernstein on television telling people what, how a symphony worked. You had public television shows about the sonnet, the poet Anne Sexton saw a PBS show about how to write a sonnet and launched a, powerful and very tortured poetic career from the fact that, of watching. My parents had these old books, these sort of Time Life, I think they were called The World of Art, and each volume had, Max Ernst was one, and, Pollock was another, and so on. And this was sort of culture for the middle class. Great culture for the middle class. The notion of middlebrow wasn't that high culture was just something, or literature or whatever, was just something for an elite. It was something that was supposed to have a broad reach. And we believed, sort of the middlebrow idea was that arts and culture and literature and all these things would deepen people, would deepen society, would make for a more sort of well-rounded, profound person. Majoring in English, say, is a kind of which my mom and my mother-in-law and a lot of people did back then. Majoring in English is a sort of classic middlebrow thing. You're saying, I care about culture. I don't know that I'm going to become a novelist, but I want to engage with this stuff because I think it's important and ennobling. And that's a really old fashioned idea at this point. And that's what but I think we've lost something very deep and profound when we gave up on it.
So what happened? Did the most highbrow thinkers among us see the middle class embracing not only the middlebrow, but also, truly popular forms of entertainment, things that are market driven and market responsive, and therefore assume that the more truly cultural aspects of middle class taste must also somehow be contaminated?
Well, I think this was, you sort of file this under, the law of unintended consequences. And I don't think it was just snobbery. I think that, every generation of, artists and intellectuals and thinkers, kind of tries to push off from the last one and tries to, sort of define themselves in a fresh way. So, part of what happened in the 60s and 70s, and a lot of the people I'm about to name, I actually like their work and was really fascinated with them when I was in college or something. But you have this longstanding idea that art is this, visual art, let's say, is a sort of door into, sort of deeper door into reality, right? Or into the sort of the inner self, abstract expressionism or surrealism bring you deeper into reality or deeper into human psychology. then you have Andy Warhol come around and say, no, art isn't really about anything real. It's art is, you know, it's about celebrity, it's about ego, it's about money, you know, that there's no difference between the art and the marketplace, say. That's kind of an interesting idea. So, okay, yeah, that sounds great. That's interesting. That's different. That's fun. It's kind of like punk rock or something. Then you have, you know, Jacques Derrida, the French, you know, critics of the period, saying that literature is not the sort of vessel of wisdom. Literature is just a system of signs, and even call it literature is a sort of snobby upper class thing. You know, it's just a system of signs. It's just a deferred signifiers that are, okay, that's, you know, I found that fascinating when I was in school, et cetera. You know, you have Pauline Kael saying film should not be this sort of seance, this communion with deeper ideas. It should be, you know, film is about, movies about sensation, you know, and about sort of the sort of sexual response. So yeah, that's cool. Great. You know, the problem is you add all this stuff up, you know, and then you have punk rock in the 70s with Johnny Rotten saying nothing matters, you know. By the end, you've basically undercut the entire, so we'll call it sort of postmodernism for want of a better word. By the end of this process, these, you know, the people who believe this stuff or who don't believe in culture anymore are now running institutions, they're critics for publications. You know, Pauline Kael, whose work, by the way, I absolutely love, but she's become the most, you know, powerful, influential critic among, you know, writers on the internet, arts, you know, critics and so on the internet. Postmodernism, you know, the French theorists dominated Yale, Johns Hopkins, you know, Brown, you know, many of the. So you have these sort of things. I know it sounds arcane, like what does this have to do with me? But when the evangelists stop evangelizing for culture and instead start to undercut it, then the people in the middle who are just sort of listening, you know, wondering if it's worth devoting their time to, say, studying the humanities or going to a museum or, you know, buying a piece of art or whatever, they start to pick it up too, and they start to say, hey, yeah, I always thought that was BS, and they've just confirmed it. You know, you see it in somebody like, so you know, if you bring it up to the present, then you have somebody like Jeff Koons, the artist, or Lady Gaga, the musician, who kind of trade on this same idea. And, you know, for them, art and culture, it's not about universal truths. It's sort of about their sort of quote unquote subversive, you know, personas and their sort of game playing with image and so on. So to some extent, the intelligentsia of the creative class created big long-term problems. And I think without intending to, this wasn't like a bunch of mean, snobby people, you know. But that's why I kind of champion the idea, the mid-century idea of Middlebrow, where we still believed in this stuff, you know, where art, the arts and culture were kind of a replacement for religion. They still had something to do with the soul. I think that idea has really dropped out, and the creative class has had something to do with it.
Journalist Scott Timberg is my guest. He's a former arts reporter for the LA Times, currently a contributor to publications including the New York Times. His new book is called Culture Crash: The Killing of the Creative Class.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Master of Liberal Studies programs. Accepting applications for summer and fall to design your own Master of Liberal Studies degree at SMU with concentrations in human rights, creative writing, and organizational dynamics. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with journalist Scott Timberg, who writes for Salon and the New York Times these days, is former arts reporter for the LA Times, and author of the new book Culture Crash: The Killing of the Creative Class. Our telephone number is 1-800-933-5372, and that's where we find Brent on the line in Arlington. Hi, Brent.
Hello. First of all, I want to thank both of you for taking on this topic. It's actually very important and interesting to me. My quick history, I've been a musician for 30 years. About 15 years ago, I dabbled in productions and created my own hobby of a productions company. I realized MP3s were going to be the next big thing. About 2007, we actually went full production. I made it my full-time job, and we did great for a while. I even produced 2 years of a travel series for an online magazine. And then 2008 came. My question is basically this. I just shut down the company this past December because of lack of business. I've always been told, and I had the understanding, that the entertainment industry is one of the few industries that skirts out from the disaster of an economic downturn. What happened this time? What's the difference in this time around?
I'm so sorry to hear your story, Brent, but thanks for calling.
Yeah, yeah. It's sad to hear that. I guess all I can say is there's a lot of that going around. I mean, you know, again, I lived this. A lot of people I know did. When I've done events at bookstores and done radio shows, I hear from photographers, musicians, blah, blah, blah. You know, I guess the simple answer is that the crisis that we're talking about doesn't just have to do with the 2008 collapse, you know, the Great Recession. That amplified and underlined some existing, you know, problems. But this stuff goes back. I mean, some of this stuff goes back a couple centuries. Let me, because you're a musician and because this is Texas, let me just give a very quick anecdote that I think gives you some of the kind of dimensions of what we're talking about here. So I was in New York the other night on my book tour, and a Texas, you know, an Austin troubadour named Alejandro Escovedo, who some of your listeners might know of, played at, you guys recognize that name,
yes,
right? So played at a place called City Winery, which is a wonderful kind of place in Lower Manhattan. So I never miss a chance to see him. So I went, you know, with a bunch of friends, and incredible show. We did an early record called, a 90s record called Gravity. And it was just sort of, you know, incredible concert, great storytelling, et cetera. So I realized the next day that Alejandro demonstrates some of the key themes we're talking about in a very tangible way. And in a way, he's sort of, I may rewrite him into the next version of the book if I do another edition. So Alejandro worked when he was sort of an apprentice musician. Like a lot of musicians, he worked at a record shop. He worked at Waterloo. And all kinds of musicians and novelists have worked at either record stores or bookstores. He also, a few years ago, almost died. He had Hep C, hepatitis C. And he, like a lot of musicians, he didn't have medical insurance because we have this myth that, you know, musicians and artists are these immortal beings who don't need, you know, regular middle class protections like medical insurance. Texas, which has a lot going for it, I love Texas music, I love Texas barbecue, has had some of the highest rates of uncovered, people without medical insurance, as I'm sure you know. He was one of them. They had to have a huge benefit to save Alejandro's life. I mean, this is one of the great musicians of our day, and he almost died because he lives in a wealthy, supposedly civilized country that did not provide a safety net for people like him who got sick. Okay, third, you guys might know Alejandro, and I know Alejandro, and a bunch of my friends do, and everybody in that club thought he was great, but he's still largely unknown outside, you know, musicians and journalists and maybe some people in public radio. So he demonstrates something that goes way back, which is that the marketplace doesn't always sync up with culture very well. In other words, the popular stuff isn't always the good stuff, and vice versa. So these things I'm talking about, you know, all of these things predate the recession. The destruction of record stores and bookstores, in other words, the kind of scaffolding that allows musicians to make a living and sort of get started, that's been undercut by the internet to some extent. The medical insurance issue, which may be changing, goes back decades and decades. And the mismatch of quality music, quality culture with popularity goes back decades too. So, you know, the recession sliced and diced a lot of people, including me, it sounds like, including you. But it's not the only element here. And for music, you know, if people aren't buying records anymore, it's just like newspapers with print advertising. When print advertising is gone from a newspaper or a magazine, the economic model collapses. For musicians and people like you, if records are no longer, you know, albums, if people are no longer buying the physical object, it gets real hard to bring that back. And, you know, music industry revenues are down, what, 50%, 60%, something like that, since 2000, since Napster hit and piracy hit in around 2000 or so. It's just fallen off a cliff. So, it's more than just the recession. There's all kinds of sort of wheels within wheels here. So my condolences about what you're going through. I understand.
Maybe I'm old-fashioned, but to this day, it shocks me when I find out that someone has chosen to steal music rather than pay for it, especially when you can get a song for a buck or two.
Yeah. I mean, it's funny. My wife is a school librarian, and she's at a high school here in California. She works with really nice, earnest kids who are readers and they're thoughtful people and so on. And she's a former music critic and a music lover, and mentioned something about buying records and paying for music. And she said they looked at her like she had
right.
You know, horns growing out of her head or something. They just couldn't believe it. And it's not just true of teenagers. It's you know, I think it's you know, even people in their 20s and probably 30s grew up in a different environment than we did. And to them, music, you know, David Bowie, I think it was him, said something like, someday music will be free like the air or something like that. Well, it's a nice idea, you know, if we had a sort of utopia where everybody could make a living and live how they wanted to. But if musicians and artists and craftsmen can't make a living, I think we all pay the price. And if you don't pay for culture, you know, you're in the middle of a pledge drive. If you don't pay for culture, the culture will stop happening. It's that simple.
For artists, Scott, who are determined to stick with it but are forced to survive on, you know, sort of cobble together maybe a gig in their art form here and then a week in an office job there and that sort of thing, I mean, what's the effect on their work, their artistic output?
Well, there's no question that these days, you know, an artist of any kind needs to be more aware of the marketplace, needs to be more self-promoting, needs to be on social media. You know, if you're making an album or a film or whatever that you care about, you need to, you need to spread the word yourself, especially if you're not part of a label or a publishing house or whatever. And things like Kickstarter and so on have been good for some people I respect. I mean, Stuart Murdoch, the lead singer of Belle and Sebastian, one of my favorite bands, you know, crowd-funded his recent film. The problem with this, as a broader model, though, is if artists and writers and, you know, so on need to be kickstarting all the time and tweeting like mad and, you know, on Facebook constantly, I mean, A, they can't do their work. I mean, you know, like the whole point of it, you know, they got into this stuff because they loved music or they love poetry, they love filmmaking. I mean, you're close to the university at Denton, right? Which is an important, you know, jazz.
University of North Texas, absolutely.
Right, yeah, which is, you know, important, you know, I think maybe in the first, you know, jazz program in the States is an important program. So jazz musicians have a term that I like, and I think every artist does this one way or the other, which is called woodshedding. You know, woodshedding is when a musician sort of goes into an isolated, you know, space for years and sort of develops his or her voice, whether it's on a saxophone or writing sonnets or working as a photographer, whatever. You know, it's about a sort of silent apprenticeship and a kind of accruing of depth and expertise and sort of a personal vision. You can't do that if you're constantly tweeting every single idea you have. So the other dimension of this, you know, is that you start to drive out a certain kind of artist. You know, if you have to be online all the time and self-promoting all the time, I mean, would we have had John Coltrane, who was in some ways a very shy guy who practiced saxophone for 9 hours a day? Would we have had the poet Elizabeth Bishop, who was not a backslapper or a self-promoter? would we, you know, think of the more introverted and sort of monastic and sort of, you know, quiet kind of artist? I mean, a lot of the people I like fit that category. You know, Eric Dolphy is another jazz musician who I really adore. I mean, you know, some are really outgoing, you know, like we probably would have had a James Brown or something. I mean, he you know, he was really driven and outgoing. But you lose a whole strata of culture makers if you've got to be a full-time entrepreneur and self-promoter as well as being a full-time artist.
And here you are having to stump the book, but it was a great conversation.
Yeah, the great thing is, for me, I love doing this, but for me, it'll be over. I can go back to what I do. But it's important for me to get the word out, and I really appreciate your interest in the project.
Scott Tinberg's new book is called Culture Crash, The Killing of the Creative Class. Scott, it really was a great conversation. Thank you so much for making this time for us.
Great. Thanks for intelligent questions.